Welcome to This Is Your Afterlife, conversations with artists and activists about death and life. I'm Dave Marr. I'm a comedian. I live in Chicago. 9.5 years ago, I survived a month-long coma, and I woke up with questions, some of which I ask of guests like Max Fox, this week's guest, who is a writer, an editor, a translator, an organizer. Max has a lot of roles, and I started our conversation initially asking him about his time management, and I will play a little bit of that part of the conversation for you now.
How do I organize my time, or like, what do I...
Yeah, give me the way to organize. I mean, you know, very like self-interested question.
I don't know, dude. I don't feel like I have it under control at this point. I'm like, I have these projects that I am committed to seeing happen. So there's Pinko, which is like a fairly big commitment. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it's like just, it feels like it's just sort of like rounding the corner of one cycle. Like we've put this new issue together and it's now about to be published.
The issue he mentions there is the newest issue, issue 3 of Pinko magazine. Pinko is the publishing collective where Max is an editor. It is a collective for thinking gay communism together. And in addition to the new issue, Max also, as we were sort of warming up, mentioned another Pinko project.
We put together a book called After Accountability, which is another oral history of the concept of accountability.
Is it like in response to the sort of semi-left cancel culture critiques?
Not in like direct response to that, no. Okay. But it's like, yeah, it's like we'd had some curiosity about this concept and we're looking for a way to like approach it since we started the project. And then there's an opportunity to spend some time with a little bit of money attached with this like residency that we got. And in 2020, when we started working on this project, or 2021 really in earnest, it seemed like this was like a concept that kind of like summed up a lot of different contemporary and historical trends and conversations that were happening on the left. And we were like, where does this come from? Who developed this set of practices and what were their politics and why is this concept that like seems to be both really like precise and like demand like trained practitioners,
right,
and like really vague and like capable of being thrown around in these like really intense for serious reasons ways. What's happening there? What is it from?
And I play those clips for you to set the table. There are some references in this episode that I want to make sure you have so you are caught up with the conversation. The other references, things you need to know, I met Max when he was a guest on my other podcast, Genre Reveal Party, which I co-host with our mutual friend, Madeline Lane McKinley. We talked about the William Friedkin Al Pacino movie Cruising. And the last big thing you need to know is Chris Chitty. Chris Chitty was a friend of Madeline's and Max's who died by suicide. And Max posthumously edited Chris Chitty's book, Sexual Hegemony. And you can find links to all this stuff in the show notes. But I talked to Max a lot about this project and this book specifically. I've mentioned before the way in which I don't seek out death workers for this show. I seek out people whose work I respect and love, but I think there is a way in which Max is a death worker, is at least on that project and a couple of his other projects, doing death work, editing these posthumous projects for public consumption. And also translating them. Another posthumous project he worked on was Amphitheater of the Dead, a book by Guy Okungem. And he talks about that. It's not in print anymore, but there is a link to it in the show notes. You can read it for free on Max's website. So those are all of the references I want you to have in your mind as you go into this. I think this is a really interesting, unique conversation for the show. I want to mention that I produce the show without ads or corporations. So if you believe in This Is Your Afterlife, I'd love for you to become a patron. You can do that by paying me $5 or $15 a month at patreon.com/Dave Marr. When you do, you immediately get an access to an extended version of this conversation. You can hear those clips in context. I also want to thank Pigeon patrons G, Barry Fontenot, Shubha Singh, Debo, Fred Fidawa, and Katie Llewellyn. Also, now we are in the Chicago Abortion Fund's Fundathon. So I and my partner, Hope Barnes, have a fundraising page to help raise money for abortion access. You can help us. Go to the link in the show notes. Mention in your note that you found out about the fundraiser from This Is Your Afterlife. That would be fucking rad. And that's what I've got. Thank you. And here is my conversation with Max Fox. Paint your hell.
It would probably be extremely crowded, like pressed up against, let's say, it's hell, and an infinite number of people. Mm-hmm. It would be uncomfortable in a bunch of physical ways. Like it would be, you know, hard to breathe and hard to stand for long or whatever for various, you know, I don't know, hot or cold sensation reasons. Mm-hmm. What eternal torture is the concept of hell? And you're asking me to fill that in, right?
I'm asking you to even, you know, define the concept and fill that in. We don't need to go from any assumptions.
Okay. Well, you'll be able to guess where this concept is coming from.
Okay.
I think, but yeah. Maybe for now I'll say like an eternity of watching other people be tortured in certain ways, any inventive ways, cruel ways, whatever. And, you know, you're exposed to that and there's nothing that you can do to intervene.
Yeah.
That'll be pretty bad.
Yeah. There's always a sense of this question being very easily answerable in terms of just like, oh, just this, just now, just whatever is happening right now. Yeah, is the answer. I am curious because it feels like as someone whose work includes a lot of examinations of gay culture and queer culture, and, you know, my other experience with you being talking about cruising, which still... Mm-hmm. I think I really liked cruising. I think about it like once a month, I think. But it...
The movie. Yeah.
The movie. Yeah. 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 That's true. I realize the concept could have been the topic. But it seems like there's a lot of crowds in queer culture. You know? what's your relationship to... It? Are those different crowds than the hellish, packed shoulder-to-shoulder crowd that you're imagining, or are you a queer person who's like kind of skip me with the crowds?
So what's interesting about being in those situations is that you are among strangers often, but like you have your friends and you can kind of like, or you like draw strangers out of this crowd to be a sexual partner or whatever. I guess the idea of being like totally alone in that situation, like with only with people who you couldn't In this image of the crowd, I guess everybody's like facing away the whole time. Like they're just like, you know, obstacles to being able to move, or they're pressing up against you, but they're not people you can relate to.
What do you hope happens when you die?
To me?
Up to you.
I find what seems to be the reality of nothingness and that kind of absolute end to be comforting.
Really? So the cessation of consciousness doesn't bother you?
I mean, I avoid it. you know, in my life, I'm not cavalier about it, but I don't need to imagine that there is some continuation. I think the idea that it's like really final is welcome in some way. And again, it's not good. I'm not saying I'm like,
no, I understand. Did you grow up with any conceptions of something rather than nothing?
I don't recall. No, I think, I mean, my parents were very secular.
Yeah.
My family's Jewish, but there was no, like, as far as I understand, there isn't supposed to be a Jewish hell.
That's my understanding as well, but you probably have an even better I have very little understanding.
I say as far as I know, because I have seen some Jewish people who seem to be making reference to various theological sources talk about certain things. I'm just like, I thought that was the whole deal. Was that there wasn't this thing, but I don't have any memories of my parents being like, this is what happens, or like, so-and-so is an angel now or whatever. Like that, okay, that sure, was not, sure. You know?
Yeah. Cause my instinct is to say, you know, when you're like, oh, I don't have any desire for it to continue. Because I grew up with like evangelical indoctrination and and so there, so my instinct is to say like, well, why don't you have any desire for explanation of something beyond? But then I think, well, to you, that's a nonsense question, because there's no explaining like why you don't desire something that doesn't even occur to you to desire. Is that right?
Yeah.
The onus is more on me to explain like why I, you know, at times feel the need for something.
And you do.
Yeah, for sure. Mm. I'm not always proud of it, but definitely the idea of finality is more of a panicking idea than a welcome idea on average for me.
I mean, I see why people like, it's hard obviously to lose someone. And so I can see why for the survivors of a death, it's satisfying to imagine that there's some continuation of something. I think there are ways to have I don't even know what the verb here is, a dynamic relationship to people in the past who are no longer alive, but that's not to say that they like blink out of like present sort of effective existence.
Yeah.
But to then posit some kind of interior consciousness to that collection of things that are like expressing influence on the present. I don't know. I'm not categorically opposed to the very idea, but it just doesn't seem to me to be the case. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It seems like it's unnecessary. It seems like it's not a useful concept to you.
Well, I guess what I'm pushing back against is in my mind is, I wrote about this a little bit in the translation, in the intro to this book that I translated called The Amphitheater of the Dead, which is this book written on the deathbed of this philosopher named Gyokeng Gem, who in 1988 was dying of complications from AIDS. And he wrote this kind of strange sci-fi book about his life, but whatever, it's a fictional person who is very obviously him's life in 2018, imagining what would happen if there were to have been the treatments that we now have in 1988. So he's like, goes to the clinic for his like weekly or monthly like infusion. And it's a kind of a chronic thing, but like this terrifying plague in the present has now receded into memory. But he still, when he goes to the clinic, he still kind of encounters his old comrades who did pass. And I translated this book. I gave myself a deadline of getting it out in 2018. Why? I mean, time management kind of, and like it was a bit of a marketing gimmick or whatever. Yeah. But like I had some impulse that was like, I need to do this for this person, or like bring his text into the world that it predicted or described or whatever. Not because I have any concept of who Gyo Kangam is as like a sort of conscious being.
Yeah.
Or I imagined that I had some kind of relationship to this character or this person by mere fact of like working on his last words, but they nevertheless did have this kind of impelling effect on me. And they did bring me into contact with certain memories that were not mine, that were his, and people. I met his surviving partner, or like I interacted with his surviving partner or whatever. And so I was just sort of trying to think through how there's a very facile concept of death that is like purely rational and like is committed to banishing the idea of souls or whatever, or some kind of like non-corporeal human existence, that also can't think through how effects that actions have in the world in the past can have impact beyond a very sort of tightly closed concept of like what a body is or what a person is or what a sort of intention is even. And this has to do with, I think, impoverished concept of like how human social reality is constituted, which is imagines that the kind of like enclosed individual person only exists through like sort of private will, basically.
Yeah.
Or that you can only like understand what's happening through these sort of like imputed intentions or motives or interests. And yeah, the fact is that there is a level of effective reality that is extracorporeal, that's collective, and that in fact like gives the like enclosed body that can live or die its meaning. And so when a person dies, that doesn't mean that then these sort of enveloping other social realities in which they're involved just blink out of existence as if the only guarantor of their reality was this body. There are these other levels of effective activity a life takes place in.
That there are real parts of them. I'm trying to find a way to phrase it that's not new agey. Or that like sidesteps being new agey, but that it sounds like what you're saying to me, it sounds to me like what you're saying is that there are real parts of people that survive their physical death, not just saying like, oh, he's survived by his work, that they're not just static things that survive these people. They are living, dynamic, vital pieces of the person that continue to perhaps change and evolve, you know, and these things are contained in their relationships to other people, their relationships to ideas, the movement of their work, not just as a document on a hard drive or a, you know, stack of paper bound together, but the movement of their work between people is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of claim that I wish I had like a more robust, like philosophical way of arguing for.
Yeah.
But yeah, it seems pretty clear that, you know, what you call someone's life isn't just found in their physical body. It's in their relations to other people.
Yeah.
You know, and so these things can be kind of borne on into other situations past their sort of physical death.
Totally.
But yeah. I mean, it's just like, it's also a way of saying like history is real. You know, the present is not just a series of like spontaneous decisions by everybody who happens to be standing around, but that like we are carrying out plans even from centuries ago that people put in motion, that we incorporate as our own desires or concepts or whatever, but that are actually kind of unintelligible if you think about it only in those terms. That you need to have a concept of like how social reality takes place that's not just everybody comes together and decides to like act in this way this morning.
The work that you and Madeline have done together and the work you did editing Chris Chitty's book, it seems like there's a relationship to honoring plans, or I don't know if it's a relationship to legacy.
Mm-hmm.
Work. What was the name of that book? Something sexuality, right?
Like sexual hegemony.
Sexual hegemony. Okay.
Yeah.
What motivates your work on those kinds of, on say like a posthumous project? Is it an obligation to that person?
That's a good question.
Thank you.
If it were a one-off, if the only thing that I had done of this sort was for Chris, who is someone I had a relationship with, as did Madeline, you know, maybe I could say this had to do with like that strange and somewhat extreme circumstance. But, you know, yeah, it's funny that as I was working on that, I was like, I'm going to translate this book. And I did it kind of because I needed, there was like a year and a half period where it was just kind of like mysteriously moving through the publishing house's process. And it was kind of like a little bit agonizing because I imagine I had to be ready to like receive the edits back at any moment, but they had no way of telling me when it was going to happen. So it was like, I need something that I'm doing, otherwise I'm going to go crazy. And I started translating this book, and like, I didn't set out to choose this other thing that had a slightly resonant theme. It just was a short book by this author that I had on my shelf, but it was in fact quite similar in certain ways. And there have been other moments when I find myself, yeah, involved in some kind of memorializing or legacy keeping situation or project. So clearly there's something going on with that approach for me.
Do you know what it is?
I'm not sure, because if you were to ask me, like, do you venerate the past or like appreciate a legacy as valuable just because it's a legacy or whatever, I would say, no, of course not. I think that's incoherent. It's like a recipe for like real confusion. Mm-hmm. You have to discover what makes sense to you based on its value as something explanatory, not just because it has some kind of status or whatever.
Yeah.
But that can't be the whole story because I keep doing this. So I don't know.
Well, clearly the legacies that you've chosen are not static legacies. You feel some obligation to respond to or complete something in the work itself. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it does seem like it would be a terribly large coincidence for so many of these projects to be memorial or posthumous in some way.
Yeah. I mean, I think like, you know, the idea with Chris's project, you know, I think I can see now I wanted to like ward off the finality of his death. I like found a situation where I could spend another 5 years with him in this really intimate way.
Mm.
And even attempt to reconstruct, if not resurrect him from what he had left, you know, which is impossible. But now he is a kind of indelible component of my life. So I did achieve some dimension of what I had hoped with that approach to his legacy. At the same time, for the component of my life that he now is or whatever, is also a constant reminder of his absence, which is also maybe something that I would have wished to reject.
You're grateful for the reminder of his absence?
No, the kind of presence that I was able to sort of construct comes at the cost of this constant reminder of the fact that it's not him.
So this podcast grew out of one of the one-man shows that I did, which was set in the afterlife And one of the premises of this afterlife is that you get to fully relive one memory. So of all the ones you have, you get to choose one to, whenever you want, drop down into it and fully re-experience it in a particularly vivid way. Like a room you can pop into and out of whenever you want.
Mm.
If that were the case, what memory would you choose?
It's a good question.
Thank you.
There was, when I was maybe 20 or something, I had a relationship with this guy who I'd met in a different context on a trip, basically, that we'd taken together. He lived in Detroit, and he came out to California, where I was living at the time, on a road trip. And we had this romance, and not the first intense feelings of love that I'd had, but it was like, I don't know, it was like 1 or 2 weeks that he stayed with me, that we're just kind of like just devoted to pleasure. And I was like showing him all the beautiful, you know, natural scenery that I liked to go to because he wasn't from the area. And
is this in Santa Cruz?
Yeah, this was around Santa Cruz, which is an extremely naturally beautiful part of the world. It's like, yeah. Redwood forests overlooking the Pacific Ocean. It's a very, very lovely place to be. Yeah, and it felt very like, you know, this was someone who I'd met in a different context. And then to kind of like be able to draw out some experience of love from that, and then to like bring it to this new context and just like luxuriate in it at 20 or whatever. It's very nice. That would be nice to return to that. It just felt, it felt like very like out of time. I think it was like in between some years of school in the late summer.
Okay. Very little responsibility, almost no responsibility.
Yeah, exactly. Like no responsibility.
Was he also in school, or like what was his situation?
Oh God, I don't know. I think he was going to like start school. He went back to Detroit after that and started working as an EMT. The relationship did not continue for 20-year-old reasons, you know.
Sure, just sure.
Didn't really know how to make it happen.
Yeah.
Which is a shame. But yeah, it was just like a really exquisite couple of weeks of just like having sex in nature and eating delicious foods and getting high and going to the beach, et cetera, you know.
Yeah, that sounds incredible.
Hard to beat.
And it sounds like, too, I'm trying to think of my experiences of that kind of swooning when there are responsibilities. And it is interrupted. That's part of the problem, is that you then, have to go to work or have to do some annoying little task. And as much as you can swoon while you're in line at the post office, you're still having to wait to get your postage and put the package in the box.
Totally.
That's not time that you're getting to spend with your sweetheart eating ice cream or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it sounds like maybe what was memorable about this was the lack of those interruptions.
Oh, totally. Yeah. It was just like freedom and pleasure, you know?
Yeah.
And there was only so much time that was possible.
You know, right.
We both had to return to our lives.
In the initial context, it sounds like there was like a lack of that freedom. Or like, how did you all initially meet that this was so much nicer to be able to transplant the relationship?
We met doing this like exchange program in France together, which is why I know enough French to have translated this book.
Okay.
But we had both gotten ourselves sent on a family swap situation. And then the program that did this was like putting us all on a bus around some nice cities in Europe for spring break.
Yeah.
It's kind of nice. I mean, I have other memories of like, we were in Venice for a day. We're like running around the Doge's palace, like behind the security lines or whatever. So this was already some kind of like person I felt I would like steal away from reality with or whatever.
Okay.
We were like 17 or something then. I didn't feel comfortable making a romantic overture to him because I didn't know
how
his feelings were or whatever. And we were like very tightly scheduled and stuck on a tour bus with other teenagers. So it wasn't like miserable, but it just wasn't like an experience of freedom.
It sounds like you were winding the Jack in the Box on that first trip, just like building up all this energy. And then he comes to Santa Cruz and everything you could have possibly wanted becomes reality.
A bit, yeah. Yeah.
So my last big question requires some explanation that you genuinely might not have, which is that 9.5 years ago, I was in a coma for a month and almost taken off life support and eulogized on Facebook and woke up and, you know, that naturally, well, not naturally, I had to work for it, but it changed a lot of, I made it change a lot of things in my life. And so the question is, what's your coma? Which is just so much of a clever way of asking about a moment of transformation for you where before you can look back and see like, oh, that was one version of myself, and after is another distinct self. And it doesn't have to be so dramatic as a coma. It could be very mundane. And I think most people have many of these moments. And I'm curious about just one of yours.
I mean, first of all, wow, that's wild. That's a wild experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I know I like have a wish for there to be some kind of like punctual transformation, after which point it's all easy, you know? And like you can just like relax and become exactly the type of person in the world that you're otherwise straining to be. And I find now, you know, it's still a slightly motivating fantasy, but it doesn't stress me out that isn't forthcoming. Like,
yeah.
I mean, so like the very obvious answer, I suppose, would be Chris's death. Like I had a slightly different set of activities beforehand, and now I've, you know, gone through this long process with his book and with publishing it and things like that. And I am maybe less anxious about getting certain things squared away in a given situation or activity that I'm about to embark on. At the same time, it's like we started this conversation being like, I don't know how to organize my time. I don't know how to like get my work and my projects in order. I still feel kind of confused about how exactly to articulate what I think his project was and what my project is. So it did give an obvious sort of like temporal marker for before and after, but it also didn't just because of that fact, it didn't like solve all of the things I was like struggling with before and now no longer have to deal with, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's a way of a life change like that just being very logistical to be like, I embarked on a project and then I completed the project and I don't know if anything essential about myself changed.
Right. I mean, there's also a way in which I responded to that situation in the way that I did because I was already the kind of person who was going to be drawn to responding to something of that nature. And it didn't actually give anything other than a kind of like externally legible object to what I was already up to.
When you say you don't feel the need to like have things like tied up or wrapped up, does that mean because you see like, oh, well, if I were to disappear, there will be someone to do for me what I did for Chris. Is that, or is it something different that you're saying?
I don't feel that way.
Did I say
I don't feel the need to like have things wrapped up?
Yeah, I thought you said something about like not needing to have everything in order. If we were on tape, I could play back the tape.
Yeah, let's roll it back.
I swear there was something.
It doesn't sound like me.
Okay. So you do feel the need to have things squared away and wrapped.
No, I'm a kind of person who is, I don't have things in order and it stresses me out.
Okay. Yes.
And no, I don't, I really have no idea what there would be for someone to take up if I were to die suddenly. To finish.
It's interesting that all of this is going on under the surface because Madeline said that, I forget the exact words she used, but that you're one of the most like steady, not imperturbable, but kind of like you also tweeted recently about being at like a Russian bath and the woman calling you a relaxed individual, that there that you are projecting steady, calm, relaxation on some level, but that all of this turbulence is happening inside you. Are you aware of that disconnect?
A bit, yeah. I don't know if I phrased that joke properly because it was clear. It was clear she was like, "You've been in the sauna too long, and you're not keeping track of like what's what like is right in front of you. Like the sign says, don't bring your dripping."
Okay. So that's more of a like you're being thoughtless or unobservant of your surroundings.
Yeah, exactly. It's true. I've picked up now that I like give off a bit more evenness than I feel personally. Yeah. I am often fairly anxious about my situation.
Sure.
At the same time, yeah, similarly to, you know, this question of like, why do I keep returning to these projects that have something to do with like posthumous work or legacies? I clearly, despite myself, engineer situations where I have to be carrying on some kind of like steady effort to like keep a process in motion or whatever. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's a way of like managing this internal sense of anxiety that I feel.
How does that manage it?
It imposes like very clear tasks or like deadlines, or makes the consequences somewhat legible in a way that if I'm just like, today I wanted to write 500 words and I didn't get to it, and that's that. You know,
right.
Which, you know, maybe I should be spending more energy doing.
There's the anxiety.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. So you had the impulse to respond to Chris's death by taking up his work. So it didn't feel like that was a reorientation of your sort of like North Star.
I mean, I hadn't ever done anything like that before, but I remember thinking like, yeah, it just seemed kind of almost pragmatically, like not even a decision, like, okay, mm-hmm. I have the time because I don't really have a job. Everybody else around him, as far as I can tell, is like really deep in grieving, but also like has their own stuff that they seem to be taking care of. And I had some kind of, I was working in New York in this magazine. So I was like, okay, I have distance, but also like some connections in publishing or whatever. So like,
yeah,
just seems like I'm ready to do this. But then, yeah, as the process like actually unfolded, I was like, oh, maybe there's something also like characterological about my readiness to respond to this situation this way. It wasn't just a series of external conditions.
Do you feel good in a crisis?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know that I have a lot of particularly crisis appropriate talents, let's say.
Sure, but the confidence is there.
Yeah, I... So like, for example, we got a scary letter from the tax department about PIMCO the other week. Mm. And like before that morning, I was like in a total, I hadn't really gotten anything done. I was just like going anxiously from one window to the next or whatever. And then we got this scary letter and I was like, wow, all of a sudden I know exactly what to do. I'm going to like get on the phone with this person and like talk to the bank in this way and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, and afterwards I was like, wow, did I like that? Like, was that like brought me out of this kind of miserable state that I'd been in earlier that day?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you have enough anxiety and it's pointed at everything, a crisis focuses it. And you've been preparing for that the whole time. In some ways.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it justifies all the rumination and fretting.
Yeah, it's like you've been in the gym like developing crisis skills just by like thinking through situations or something.
Sure, totally. Yeah.
Yeah, I can relate to that. But so Chris's book was the first of these posthumous projects that you started working on?
Yeah. I mean, I hadn't,
cuz that's I'd it. Written, that's the big change. That's the coma is before your work didn't have this character. And now at least we're in a phase where it does. Right.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I also, maybe I'm reluctant to name that as the coma, cause I'm still hopeful that there's going to be a different one or another one. It's
of
like,
of course. I don't mean, that's why I say that like in this phase, I'm willing to consider it all coincidental, you know, that this is,
yeah,
I'm not your therapist attempting to like drill down and move you past this kind of work or keep you stuck in it either way.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I get that for sure. But do these other, maybe this is too facile, but do these other projects, you know, posthumous projects feel related to Chris in a sideways way?
Well, there aren't so many. Sure. But yes. So, yes, in a sense that Chris is also, you know, related to a set of political concerns and questions that I'm still engaged in. And so as these other projects also touch on these things, it's all part of a kind of similar field. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, there's not so many. Maybe I was overstating.
Yeah. Do you feel like I'm pigeonholing you? I don't mean to.
Oh, no, it's okay. I'm just like, I'm counting like which are the ones that
sure
that make sense to talk about like that. I think.
What are the political concerns that you're still actively taking up that you refer to?
This legacy of, let's call it gay communism, because that's the term that we use at Pinko. It's a tendency that has many different names, I guess, decides to introduce itself different ways, different times. But that there's some coherence to be developed in an engagement with questions of sexuality and questions of critique of capitalist social relations and a commitment to overcoming the present order. That this is like a coherent politics somehow. These two things go together. And that has that has something to do with how do you relate to the past. Marx talks about the traditions of dead generations weighing like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And like this is part of the sort of political task of overcoming the present, is figuring out how to properly relate to these dead traditions.
To figure out what the plans were of them. I mean, is it an act of translation? I don't mean to be too clever about it, but is it like figuring out what the plans were of these older generations and figuring out which we carry forward and which we reframe and which we leave behind?
I think the problem is that it's never so deliberate as writing out a plan. You know, it's like, what are the effects that exceeded what was planned? What were the activities that went on behind our backs as we thought we were doing one thing, but in fact, we were accomplishing its opposite or something like that.
Right. Right.
Which is maybe, I don't know, maybe that's also translation. I don't know. You know, so this question of accountability that I was talking about at the beginning, we ended up making an argument. We were trying to figure out where this concept came from, how it had emerged in this moment, and why it had taken on this like intense public character all of a sudden. And I don't know if I can reproduce the argument exactly right now, but basically the insight that we came to was about how 50 years ago, the last sort of peak of generalized uprising in the United States was beaten back by the state, but preserved in its memory as a specter, as well as preserved in the memory of the people who lived through it, or who carried out, who participated in it as partisans. And that on both sides for 50 years, consciously or not, there was a kind of like secret motor to everybody's actions and decisions, which was the memory of this uprising. Mm-hmm. And it kind of like was maybe not concealed, but like was present in the way that people were relating to questions of organizing and questions of revolution and questions of repression. And, you know, so that like materially that took the form of expansion of the prison industrial complex on the part of the state, and on the part of the insurgents that took the form of a deepening development of the political concept and practice of prison abolition. And so as these two traditions, I guess, like encountered this thing that had been their task to kind of like preserve and negate again in the present in 2020, it sort of exploded the way that these concepts concealed the memory of something in the past and revealed that like they were now encountering a limit to what they were set out to do, which was relate to the past. And now there's this new situation that they had to kind of like grapple with that they weren't always able to manage. Why did we mess up? Because to make a revolution, to actually transform all of society, social relations, opens up these unsettled accounts with the past, opens up these concepts that manage or pacify or conceal past conflicts or unfinished business. And I've talked my way so far away from what your question was.
No, what I'm hearing is that the process of engaging with history is uncovering these unsettled accounts. Mm. And the reason that's important is because if we're doing revolution without reckoning with those unsettled accounts, that we'll have to reckon with them eventually.
Exactly. They will reveal themselves.
So we might as well address them now.
Yeah.
That's the show. Go to patreon.com/DaveMarr to become a This Is Your Afterlife patron. Thank you to This Is Your Afterlife house band Lake Mary for all the music in this episode. Thank you for listening. Check out the links in the show notes to find out more about Max and Pinko, to become a patron, and to donate to my link to Chicago Abortion Fund's Fundathon. Abortion is a competition, and I'm trying to win, you know? So tell a friend who would love the show about it. If you listen in Apple Podcasts, write a little review there. And that's it for the hard commands. Right now, remember, you are a mist.